Patrick Henningsen and TNT.
Welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to TNT, today's news talk. I'm Patrick Henningsen, your host. We're into the third hour of this live broadcast on this beautiful Tuesday, wherever you are in the world. Thank you very much for joining us. And we had a fabulous conversation, a really fascinating talking with Greg Sharkey before the break in the last hour about the music industry and about how some of the rebels that we once grew up with and revered seem to have become fallen heroes because of one political twist or turn or another, and what they used to call in the music business selling out. It's a really interesting conversation, and we went fairly deep on that, but we could go a little bit deeper. Perhaps we'll leave that for another time. Now, I want to welcome our next guest onto the show. I'm very much looking forward to this conversation. Filmmaker Igor Lopatinok is joining us, and he has made a number of, well, quite high-profile documentaries in recent years. The one that probably people know the most is Ukraine on Fire, featuring Oliver Stone, but also Revealing Ukraine, which is effectively a sequel, if you will, to that first film, and Kazakh, A History of the Golden Man. This is a film about the former Soviet Republic of Kazakhstan. But his work is legion to the people that follow it, and we're very pleased to be welcoming on the program this week. Hello, Igor.
Hello, Christian. Nice to, thank you for having me. It's a big pleasure. Even it's early time in Los Angeles, I'm with you and very pleased. Thank you.
Thank you very much for joining us, Igor. And now, Igor, I just want to start off by saying I saw Ukraine on Fire. It was probably your most well-known documentary film. I saw it a few years ago, around 2016, 2017. And you know, I thought it was pretty impactful at the time. And you featured some great people in there. Robert Perry, the journalist, Oliver Stone, obviously, maybe the most high-profile American person in that film. But did you expect, I mean, it's really, your film has taken on a new life this year. It's really shot into another level. I mean, tell us about this experience. First of all, how did that project come about?
Yeah, we definitely experiencing the rebirth of the audience interest to the film. I need to point out that Oliver films aging pretty well. If you look on his feature works, like Natural Born Killers or others, 25 years pass and it's still fresh. Why is it? Because it's truthful. It's talking about something what not resolved yet. And exactly same fate strike in Ukraine on Fire. When we start doing this in 2013, after that go to 2014, 15, and releasing in 2016, we think we is a little bit overdue because that event starting in 2014, but nothing was changed in 2016. And you catch the first wave interest of audience to Ukraine on Fire. And of course we was suppressed and we was, it was very hard to find a distribution for the film. Not only in the United States, but around the world, with only exception of Russia, because Russia was jump on the car immediately because it was so critically important for them. But when that war started and Ukraine started falling apart and everything what we tried to prevent by our film, everything what we tried to be to make people be aware what is a danger of the big war and escalating war to the World War III, it's starting to happen. Oh, this time that audience jump on a interest to film, I believe also because the naming title is called Ukraine on Fire. Ukraine is the first, and it was very much Googled war. And the people who is coming to the platform, for example, to Apple TV or Amazon and type in just Ukraine, they see our film. And but not only because of that, you mentioned Oliver Stone and Robert Perry. Oh, Robert was a passed away great journalist who teach me a lot how to dig story, how to be deep and how to be conscious. He did very good commentaries. We also have access to two key speakers in the Ukrainian Fire. We're featuring Vladimir Putin and Viktor Yanukovych. Viktor Yanukovych was also president of Ukraine, who was democratically elected before, and 2014, because of bloody coup in Ukraine, he was in exile. He ran away to Russia, ran for his life. They planning to him the fate of Salvador Allende in Chile. They want to him be killed. They arranged the assassination attempts on him, deploying the snipers. And it was, trust me, that was not Ukrainian snipers. But he managed to escape, and we met him in the December 2014 and interview him like extensively, 3 hours for the film, asking them questions what's probably never was asked. For example, when they was walking outside, Oliver asked him such a brutal question, where you think you're gonna die? And he was surprised, but he think about if we're gonna die in Ukraine or in exile. So it was brutal, it was honest, and this is why the film stand well. Nothing was resolved. Everything was Ukraine was put in that crisis in 2014, just escalate. And this is why we decide to make another film, Revealing Ukraine. In 2019, we release it. And if somebody from audience watch Revealing Ukraine, this is a very little ending, where I believe very prophetic. We practically describe the situation, what's going on now. In 2019, nobody listened. No, of course, progressive audience, who is our audience, listen to this and they try to be vocal. But this is a very tiny percentage of people. And we, of course, again, was suppressed from the big distribution. I need to say, with a lot of effort, we penetrate that distribution barriers. We practically everywhere. We in Amazon, we on Apple TV, we on iTunes and other numerous platforms. And audience get an access to alternative view. So this is our, I probably think, most important goal, to give to people another side of metal. And another side of metal, of course, brutal, of course, dark, and there's a lot of conspiracy ongoing on this side.
And your film...
Yeah, uh-huh.
Oh, go ahead. Go ahead. Go ahead, Igor. Go ahead.
Now, how we decide to make a film, 2013, we was curious to make the film about Ukraine for a couple of years. I'm Ukrainian. I was grown up in Ukraine. I was born in Soviet Union in 1968. And after that, I moved to United States 2008. From 2010 and 2011, I understand Ukrainian, political vivarium, you know, the place, the zoo. Need to be somehow highlighted, somehow explained, because it's a lot of things going on, and we see that signs of something cooking. So we start thinking about making film. We attach Oliver Stone. It was another story how I get to Oliver. Actually, because of friends, I work for one film that was produced by Moritz Bormann, very well-known producer, and that was a movie of Andrew Konchalovsky, Nutcracker, big movie, major movie, with Elle Fanning. And I was just a 3D producer who did the 3D conversion for that film. But when I approached Oliver later, and he asked Moritz, who is Igor, he said, oh, I know the guy, we was working together. This is how I get to the Oliver Army. And I'm very proud about it. I call myself student of Oliver, because I study a lot. He teach me very hard way, pointed all my mistakes, and but I believe I did it good. I even have my own style using metaphor and a drama principles in a documentary. And I believe this working well, because the hard politics, especially geopolitics and foreign policy of United States, is very hard to make that digestible and explain it to audience. By using metaphors and using all three acts of drama structure, helping. Thank you.
And There's another film called The Everlasting Present. 30
yeah.
years of
yeah.
independence in Ukraine. And when we say independence, it's in dependence, as in dependent. That's a kind of a sequel. It's a kind of sequel, isn't it, to the other two, right?
Yes, it's like our fourth film, because we start with a very small movie, like a 57-minute called Maidan Massacre. That was like a true crime investigative attempt when we use the ballistic and other scientific techniques of crime investigation to find out who was shooting on Maidan in 2014. After that, Ukrainian Fire was big major hit sequel revealing Ukraine. And our latest on the subject was released August, I believe, 24 last year, called 30 Years of Independence, The Everlasting Present. The Everlasting Present is like Groundhog Dog, like, you know, David, you're waking up every morning and same day, and you're facing same problem, and you cannot catch up. This is 30 years of Ukrainian history, the actually way to the abyss. Very sad way, because country, biggest country in Europe, just falling apart. And the quality of people living, first of all. And I believe that's the biggest. And, you know, now when everybody praising Zelensky, like, oh, great leader. That's great leader lead his country, his nation to the war, what he cannot win. How you can call him, compare him to Churchill? Churchill was winning the war. He was fighting against the evil, and he was winning, unifying nation, sacrificing lives for the victory. And that guy just leading the entire nation to abyss, sacrificing for nothing, just for, you know, happiness management of a military industrial complex in the United States. This is a difference, a big one.
So you brought up the subject of the current president of Ukraine, Zelensky.
Yes.
Igor, nobody has ever seen anything like the sort of star treatment that he's been given. He's almost a prophet. He's a world leader, the president. You know, some people called him president of the world. Like, he should be, if there was a world government, Zelensky should be the president. The West have fallen head over heels in love with him, at least at the beginning of this. As a Ukrainian, looking at this scene after February 25th, 2022, in the Russian military intervention in Ukraine, and looking at how Zelensky has been elevated to this level. I mean, what are your thoughts? What do you think about this? Because we've never seen anything like this in modern history.
Let me tell you, I know Vladimir Zelensky before. I know him as how a B-plus actor, comedian, and a very successful producer who in the Ukrainian industry. And I tried to work with him from referral of my friends. We can't make anything together because he was all the time busy. He's boarding the plane, he's exiting from the plane, he's in a meeting, he's exiting from the car, jumping in the car. So I try in 3 months, and when I listen to that terms of deal, I said, no, thank you. I'm not going in. This is a first. And probably he take this ticket to be a president from the hands of very ruthless oligarch Igor Kolomoisky, whom I know also personally because I was born in the same city when he was born, Dnipropetrovsk. That guy was also jump on a wagon in 2014. He was a governor of Dnipropetrovsk area. He's a billionaire who is under big investigation here in the FBI in the United States for money laundering. They're laundering like tremendous amount of money, like 800 billions in the United States through his bank. And that bank and that man financed the Zelensky campaign. And Zelensky was just a good actor, you know, nobody else. With a very little to nothing governance experience, with a good voice, with who can look, truthful on a screen. And there's very little moral standard, because as an actor, he can play anything what they give him. Any script, he will deliver. But why I call him B+? Because he not A. They, you know, what's making actors look like A, like a Tom Cruise or others. You cannot compare that people to Zelensky. Zelensky is not so big. So you feel that little bit of lie, little bit of uncertainty or something inside of him. And of course, you know, they make him a big one. They make Biden president of United States. What do you think? They can do everything. That's exactly the same forces. The same forces of under Democratic Party here in the United States, who choosing the president of United States instead of elected one, choosing that who is fitting well. So, and they grooming him, of course, and they groom Zelensky to the point of leader of free world. But it's, you know, that's not the end of the story. This is just the, we are approaching to the third act. We're not in the end yet. I, as a filmmaker, as a director, I can tell you it's a drama story. It's not, and even tragedy. So it will be no happy ending for Zelensky.
Well, that's an interesting point you just made at the end. Have you noticed this, Igor, in the last 2 or 3 weeks? The Western media has begun to pivot. They've begun to turn to kind of now admitting in major papers like the Washington Post, New York Times, a few comments on the mainstream media saying, well, actually, Ukraine's not doing so well militarily. They're taking massive losses daily in terms of soldiers killed, injured. They're outgunned. And almost like they're saying there's no chance that they could win. And then so pressure then comes to bear on Zelensky, because now the excitement's over, now the hype is over, and people are waking up from this hangover of all the excitement of getting behind Zelensky and realizing that this president might have lost a third of Ukrainian territory, and how, who knows how many soldiers, young men and old men, who have been conscripted. Is this not a huge disaster for the country? And what would happen to him as a result if he then becomes blamed by his own people? Because I think that's a big danger for Zelensky, is he could end up being blamed by Ukrainians for making the wrong decisions.
My existing scenario for Zelensky, it's four scenarios and no one have a happy ending for him. First of all, yes, you're right. This is impossible for Zelensky in these conditions what Putin put in place to win this war militarily. And they do not negotiate the condition of their surrender or condition of peace, because they have very bad cards on hands. They want some, you know, they want some trumps. They want some jokers. They want to win. They want to liberate, liberate, because Russians was not like a pushed away from the Kiev. Russians was retreating in order from the Kiev. But Ukrainian propaganda and the mainstream media and the West show it as a victory of Ukrainian army. And everybody like you're believing in this lie. Second, Zelensky probably will face the coup. And I believe that will be a military coup, because, and we already have signs of this coup ongoing in Ukraine. Yes, he cannot deliver anything, only just kind of informational events. They can do something what can be like, you know, multiplied and put it on the screens and put it on the storylines and the headlines of all mainstream publications or media around the world. But win this war military, they have no capacity. And they have, I believe they have no will to do this. So they practically, they best case scenario, they obtain some military victories on the battlefield, and after that negotiate with Russians peace. But Russians start negotiation on the second day, and it was already conditions in place and terms of deal. The Ukraine just disagree with this. They still living in an illusion, what backed by all, how to say, West, not entire world, but West, they can win. They can win something. And this all rhetorics about liberating of Crimea and Donbas, it's like a practically from the land of fairy tales, because Russians has a nuclear armaments in Crimea. And this is actually explanation why they fight in this military operation this year, not the next one. Why they not patiently wait. When State Secretary Blinken saying the unprovoked incursion, unprovoked intervention of Russia, unprovoked war, they lie, of course, because that was provoking. That was provoking in a very many way, but biggest way was readiness to Ukraine to give up on non-nuclear status and regain the nuclear weapons, what Zelensky make public on February 19. And this is, was together with the biolabs and all development of biological weapons and militarizing of territory of Ukraine, practically making that NATO member without membership. That was the red lines what was crossed. And this is why I believe the military analytics and Putin himself, who is a very good in analytical skills, they understand if they don't do this year, to next year or 2024, they're going to fight in Crimea when Ukraine going to be attacking their territory, and they need to be using nukes to defend, because it's logistically much, much harder to fight, much, much harder to defend. And without tactical nukes, they probably going to lose the war. And probably Ukraine at this time will be a member of NATO. So decision was very hard. Decision was very sad, because every war, doesn't matter, it's even liberation. This is a war and innocent people dying. So, but they decide make this year to limit the casualties and to take nuclear card out of the table, make it war non-nuclear. So this is a very hard decision. I cannot imagine anybody in the West. You need to be a real leader. You need to show all leadership qualities to make that decision was actually painful, actually. Understanding that trillions of dollars will be raised from economy of your state, but you're ready to pay that price because you're fighting for your own existence. This is a motivation of Russia in this war. That said, Ukraine, it's not a goal for Russia. Russian existence, eliminating threats for Russia. This is a goal of this operation of Russia in Ukraine. And for Ukraine, is no reason to fight with Russia, because Russia will not disappear from the northern border of Ukraine. We are nations who live, I call them we are, because I can call myself Ukrainian, American with Ukrainian roots. I feel myself really ashamed, because people don't understand what's everything was going on in Ukraine, not going for Ukrainian people, it's going for Ukrainian regime. And the Ukrainian, and the result, you know, that's a very good example. Remember Afghanistan, how that disaster ended. We left behind, we pumped such a lot of weapon in Afghanistan. Weapon do not fight themselves. Weapon is just tools. People fight. And 300,000 army of the regime in Afghanistan failed in a few days. Of course, they was fighting not against the military power of Russia. They were fighting against rebellious Taliban, but it still was a war, and this war ended up badly. So this will be exactly the same end in this war, but look on this price that Ukraine paying for this. If you look on the numbers of military casualties, that's varying from 300 to 1,000 a day, and it's giving us like at least 9,000 a month, and we in the third month, so it's already like we can predict like more than 30,000 of casualties in Ukrainian army only. And this is very, very, like, you know, careful the estimate. Probably it's much more. For God's sake, for why Ukrainians need to pay this price? Just because somebody making a big margin and profit in the producing that rockets and others. It's ridiculous.
So I know you've looked at this very closely. Your you're looking at it daily. In fact, it's probably one of the things that you're probably thinking about all day based on the information you're seeing coming out for the last 3-4 months. So in your opinion, as things stand right now with this conflict, what do you think the best possible outcome is for Ukraine? And what do you think the worst possible outcome could be, depending on how things go in the next 3 to 6 months?
You know, Patrick, European position is very, very dumb for me, because first of all, they played in this conflict. They was, inserted inside. It started not in February. It started when Victoria Nuland, famous call, when they choosing who gonna lead Ukraine, and they said the EU, actually on the phone. And so they all the time, the neoconservative or neo-interventionalism or people who want this war to happen. And Victoria Nuland probably is a very, face of these people, who is Undersecretary of State, but practically she is bigger than the Blinken in this war. And for them, it's no reason to care about Ukraine. That's a reason to care about their own interests. And that famous Adam Schiff make a statement in our Senate and said, we're fighting Russians there, so we not need to fight them here. Let's help Ukraine. So practically, this is a very brutal and very dishonest concept formulated in a time of Cold War, and nothing changed for the United States. Nothing.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Please continue.
Yes. And so tell us as well, what I thought was interesting, Ukraine on Fire, you began creating this film in 2013. So this, I would imagine that's pre-Maidan. We saw scenes of John McCain, Senator Chris Murphy on stage with Oleg Tanihuk, getting the crowd revved up, and McCain made promises to the people that the United States was going to be their best partner and to help them defeat the Russians and so forth. And so when you were looking at this story early on, and you're in America now, so you now really understand the power of propaganda. Anytime anybody mentions neo-Nazis or anything like this, the American reaction on most of the networks and politicians is, oh, that's Russian propaganda. There is no Nazi problem in Ukraine. It's a fringe thing. There's a few, maybe some tattoos. It's not really a significant factor. Explain to us what your viewpoint is on the reality of that situation.
And the reality of this situation, that's United States feed up and grown Ukrainian Nazi for 70 years. They pick up the card from the Nazi Germany as soon as, and the necessity of Cold War, they forgive to all that brutal Nazi collaborators, like Lebedev or others. It's in our film. They covering them up through that immigration process. They change their names and they use them against Soviet Union, because it was a Cold War, and the rule, enemy of my enemy is my friend, was deployed in all full brutality. So there's no, even United States recognized that Stepan Bandera and other Ukrainian nationalists who rain the terror on the heads of their own nation, brutal criminals, they still collaborate with them because they need the fighters, and they was motivated fighters. And this is started in the operation, and now we have declassified CIA materials about all of this. They groom them, they train them, they paradrop them in Ukraine, western part. Immediately the Soviet KGB catch them and execute. So it was a very little success, but they building, and they accelerate, and Soviet Union collapse, and Ukraine was much more open. And Ukrainian diaspora in the United States working in unison with the American government, trying to subvert the country to flip to the West. And, you know, the flipping to the West, this is not very good for Ukraine, an opposite way. You know, if you remember, very little people in the West know why this all 2014 Maidan happened. Why was people protesting? Because the current sitting prime minister, not even president, decide to postpone the trade agreement with European Union. And this is that was used as a pretext for the protest on the street. And what this trade union agreement, why Russia was so against that? They negotiate the condition with the World Trade Organization for 15 years, trying to protect their market, trying to carefully construct that agreement in the right way. And Ukraine was jump and said, oh, we want to open our border to inflow of goods from Europe, but we want to keep also free trade agreement with Russia because of energy. And this is not supposed to happen anyway because Russia will against that. Russians demand we want to be part of this negotiation because it's affecting our interests and affecting our economy in a major way. Europeans say no to Russia. They said, there's no way you will negotiate because Ukraine is an independent country and they can do whatever they want. Oh, of course, Russia said then we will cancel the trade agreement with Ukraine. And the president of Ukraine, the Yanukovych, and this time choose, do not postpone, just postpone. And he also give up on his political career. They signed an agreement in the 18th of February to called the early election in December in 2014. So everything was happened, this bloody coup, but it's all machine was already in motion and they understand they start killing the people for their goal. So if they killing the people and they will be prosecuted after that for that killing, so they cannot stop. This is why they also, as soon as it's all ended up and the regime was changed in Ukraine in February 2014, they immediately jump on the wagon of war in Donbas because they need to war. They need to go to war to cover up their wrongdoing on the streets of Kiev. They need to cover up that bloody coup. They don't want to be prosecuted. So they start the military operation in Donbas. Ukraine starts shelling the cities and killing innocent civilians in their own country. And the man who's called Alexander Turchinov, who's an interim president, he's announced that at all, like an anti-terroristical operation in Donbas. And this is how that war was started. Because everything what we're facing now in February, this is not the beginning of war. This is the end of war. Because that conflict was started 8 years ago. And European position was all the time a little bit lazy in the beginning. And they was forced by United States. They was forced by Biden and Victoria Nuland to join the company to jump on the sanctions was actually failing because Russia has hundreds of years experience resisting to sanctions. And now Russia is a big self-sustainable country. You have every need resources, starting from the food and finishing with the military equipment what they produce. And that's a very successful, I think it's a top-notch military hardware because that not they're not importing anything for that from the West. So Europe was forced to do that, and now Europe was forced to kill the entire energy structure and to give up on the Russian energy, what's crucial and very important for existence of European economy. And I believe now Europe paying this price. They more and more will understand. If you listen to the Putin statement in St. Petersburg a few days ago, he said, elite will be changed and substituted because they make a wrong choice. They do not think about their own interest. They're thinking about interest of Washington. And this is why they're here. So I feel sad about Europe.
Yes, you're not alone. You're not alone. And you're absolutely correct, Igor. They're not acting in their own interests. And that is the most baffling part of this, Germany being probably the most obvious one in that category. But I'm here talking with filmmaker Igor Lopatinok, and he is the director of Ukraine on Fire, Revealing Ukraine, and a number of other very, very crucial documentary films. We're going to take a short break here with TNT Today's News Talk. I'm Patrick Henningsen, your host. Stick around. We'll be right back after this break.
China's authoritarian, tyrannical COVID zero policy worked perfectly, according to a professor.
From Washington, D.C., this is the Morano Minute with your host, TNT Radio's Mark Morano.
Professor Alan Wu, director of the Center for Public Health Research at Nanjing University, claimed that China's COVID policies were the model of the world.
The zero tolerance policy has been working very well. It actually put the virus under strict control, and you avoid a large scale outbreak and a large number of deaths. But in the Omicron, the situation is quite different. The virus is so transmissible, so infectious.
Yes, you heard that right. Zero COVID in China was a great success until that nasty Omicron came along and exposed it for the failure that it was. Lockdowns kill. Tyrannies kill, COVID policy killed, until the world realizes that COVID lockdowns were one of the greatest humanitarian crises we've faced. We are doomed to repeat it. For the Morano Minute, this is Mark Morano on TNT Radio.
I've got muscular dystrophy. That means my muscles are weak and it can be hard to breathe. During COVID-19, kids like me are at a greater risk. But the Muscular Dystrophy Association is here to help.
MDA is what ensures they receive critical medical care at one of over 150 care centers.
COVID-19 won't stop us.
Please visit helpmda.org.
Get breaking news on your phone when it happens. Download our app from the Google Play and App Store now.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to TNT Today's News Talk. I'm Patrick Henningsen, your host. We're in the final stretch of the third hour, and we're having a really powerful discussion right now with Ukrainian-American filmmaker Igor Lopatinok. He is the director of Ukraine on Fire, Revealing Ukraine, the Everlasting Present, and also Kazakh History of the Golden Man, a number of really phenomenal documentary films. He's joining us on the line right now. And Igor, we got a few questions for you in the final stretch.
Yes.
Here. And I'm in studio with Greg Sharkey. He's joining me riding shotgun this week on the program. We'll get to Greg in a second. But I wanted to ask you what everybody wants to know, Igor, is Vladimir Putin featured as well in your films, and so was this an interview that you conducted with your crew? If so, what was that experience like?
Oh, it's very very powerful when you're speaking to a real leader, and he allocates his time to answer your stupid question, because you know, to even ask the Putin the right question, you need to be prepared at least 10% as he is informed on the subject, and we got an hour for Ukraine on Fire, and we got much more, like up to 3 hours for Revealing Ukraine. And Oliver, with his amazing film, Interview with Putin, 4 episodes, they met, I believe, 9 times for that 2.5 years, and they discuss everything. Why Oliver do this, and why he did it in this way? Because he was accused a lot of time to be a Putin apologist, et cetera, not asking brutal dictator, bloody dictator, and they call Putin. The questions would try to explain his position. The Oliver mission here is very critical and important. Look at our media. Every our media just sitting in a wagon and pushing the narration was that Putin is a perfect villain who is masterminding against the Western civilization, who tried to destroy America and Europe and conquer it. And this is a dangerous illusion. And this is making the audience completely do not understand. So I believe that Oliver's goal and mission was to give Western audience a different perspective, an alternative vision. And for that reason, do not go on attack. Do not ask the questions what can be immediately lead to the conflict in front of camera, but try to open up as a director working with the actor. Usually, you know what, this is he's probably what he's doing the better than anybody live director now, because Oliver, I believe, make more than 40 leaders to documentaries. And we can call Hugo Chavez, Fidel Castro, Yasser Arafat, Putin, and others. And this is how he's working. He's working as a director with actors. He see that reaction and he try to use his directorial skills to open up the character, to let character talk in a way what's showing his inner thoughts, showing the core. And I believe he succeed, even Oliver himself saying that Putin is very much protected and very much controlled, cold, and a calculated person. But if you look on the interview with Putin, you can find out all principles of this man. And the principles, this is what his belief. And he tell that to us in the reveal in Ukraine when he was talking about Viktor Medvedchuk. He called him the man with the principles. That's a big recognition to him. And in Ukrainian Fire, he tell us very interesting statement about to make an order in their own lines, the NATO alliance or West, collective West, need a villain, because Iran do not fit well. Iran has no nuclear weapons and this is too small, so they choose him. And he understand it, but the West choose him to be a villain. And you know, Oliver screened to him the amazing movie of Stanley Kubrick, Doctor Strangelove, or How to Stop Worrying and Fall in Love with a Bomb. This is amazing movie about how World War III can be started accidentally. And this was the biggest fear for Oliver. It's the biggest fear for me. You know, my background, I was studying rocket science back in Soviet Union, and I was an engineer for ICBM engines, for liquid-propelled rockets. So I know how powerful, how devastating these weapons is. So my goal as well is do something for the peace for this humanity. Try to explain something and try to avoid what will be our, like, a last war. And unfortunately, what we're showing in Ukraine that have all signs of World War III. Thanks God it's still non-nuclear, but and we still fighting. This is why I'm so thankful for you, because in a censorship time, and let me talk about this a little bit. It's a jumping out of your question, but yeah, the censoring of Russian media, it's not only that's a censoring of everyone. This is a policy of the current, the Western civilization, because if you don't fit in a narration, you're not allowed to be in the field. You need to be eliminated, you need to be ridiculed, you will label it and put on the side as a trash. But, you know, the human minds and our audience is smart. And they feeling they be manipulated. This is why Ukrainian Fire gaining such a lot of attention, because it's showing totally different causes in this conflict, this totally different trajectory and different actors behind the scene, especially, is very interesting. This is why to approach the leaders who are the decision makers and ask them a question, not in a way what immediately, like, you know, go into the conflict, but in a way what layer by layer explaining the situation. That was our goal, and I think we succeed with this goal. We show the position of Putin and position of participant in that conflict. We show that very clear. So first of all, this is not about Ukraine. This is a proxy war against Russia, and this is not running by Ukrainians. This run from Washington, D.C. And it's not all Americans people want this war. This is only people whom you can call neoconservative or neoliberals, who is an interventionalist, who want to change something, doesn't matter what the force you need to use for that. So this is their goal. This, when we call them they, we can call that deep state of United States. Let's remind me that meeting with Ronald Reagan and Gorbachev in Reykjavik in late 80s, when the Gorbachev proposed to Reagan eliminate the nuclear weapon and disband the NATO and Warsaw Pact. And well, Reagan was quite happy about the idea of Gorbachev to disband the Warsaw Pact, but with nuclear weapon, he was very pissed. You know, he don't understand why that man talking about the bomb, how to survive without the bomb. And Gorbachev was ready to do that because that was a time when the doomsday clock was a 15 minutes again before the midnight, biggest time. Now we have 1 minute and a half, and I believe myself we less than 30 seconds. Very sad. But that time it's not happened, and the nuclear shadow is again overshadowing our future. And this is a big danger here.
It absolutely is. I'm here with Gregory Sharkey. He's from Northern Ireland. Greg's got a question for you, Igor.
Mm-hmm. I would just like to say I wholeheartedly agree with your analysis this past hour or so. Particularly talk about Russia's war of choice today for national security is opposed to a war of survival for Russia, possibly next year. And also when you're talking about Zelensky, the outcome for Zelensky, you know, would it be a coup by the people, or do you believe it would be a coup by the military?
Yes, I believe military will go, because, you know, even a coup against from the people, it's hard to reach so much faster than the coup from the military, because the conflict will be emerged in his inner circle. And I believe it's already emerging with his military commanding. And we see all the signs of this, because Zelensky, as a politician who has no military skills and no idea what he's doing in the battlefield, he will be opposed and he will make wrong choices. He will send the military and something not executable, not winnable situation, just because he need to do that from political point of view. And this will increase tension with the military, people who is more and more questioning his actions, his course of actions. And I believe this is not a matter of months, this is a matter of weeks.
Yeah. And on the proxy war, I mean, just like Maidan Square was the most blatant coup, I would believe, in recent history, this is the most blatant proxy war. I mean, do we know of any other previous proxy war that is as blatant a proxy war as this current one?
Oh, we can call the proxy war in Afghanistan. We can call the proxy war in Vietnam. And we can call the proxy war in Syria, of course. And this is where you need to study these results of these campaigns to understand how it's ending. So Syria was a clear win for Bashar al-Assad and Putin. And Vietnam was a disaster for when the last time when American people stand up united and stop this war. And the Afghan war was a disaster for Soviet Union, because in this proxy war, they was disconnected from the Afghani people, and Afghani people was organized by West and Iran against them. And so the history has also, you know, the Korean War. So practically everything, if you think about World War II, and if you look who was funding the Nazi Germany rise, and who was helping to Stalin to industrialize the Soviet Union and make that military power, mighty military power, you will find out what both the roots of this sitting in New York and the bankers who's making great profit on this. So the war, it's a very profitable business. In America, in this business for centuries. So this is why, you know, but overall, this is a wrong choice, because when you spend in the GDP, a percentage, a big percentage of your gross domestic product to making weapons, you forgetting about healthcare, about forgetting about education, forgetting about social benefits for your own citizen. You just, so like a military industrial complex business is profitable only to people who benefit from military industrial complex business. This is not profitable for humanity, and the cost of this business, it's a blood and losses of human lives. This is why it's unethical for me. This is why it's immoral. This is why I do not share that ideas, because making the profits, killing the people, this is wrong, completely wrong. This is why we all here and we're sharing our vision, because it's immoral, just immoral. It's evil.
Absolutely. Yep.
Those are the only people winning so far that I see in on this U.S. Western-backed Ukrainian proxy war are the defense contractors. They're doing incredibly well out of it. Igor, look, we got a couple of minutes left, and I just wanted to ask you this final question, because they tried to cancel you. I saw they tried to take your film off YouTube. I think they successfully did. I'm not sure, but I was very impressed with your reaction, Igor. You immediately took to Twitter. You said to everybody, this is where you go, buy it on Vimeo, download it, re-upload it, whatever. And I saw your film just like a multiply, like a mushroom, mushroom farm after that. It's everywhere. So because they went to cancel you and you went to the people and you said, let's do this. And the people did it. And now more people have seen your films than ever before. That's an incredible story, Igor.
Yes, thank you. We make a right decision, and we make it very fast. So first of all, how it's happened. Suddenly, YouTube just delete Ukrainian Fire from YouTube. And this was not the main our copy. That was just a copy for people who have no access to Amazon, Apple TV, or other platforms who want to see the film. So I tell it to Oliver. We spoke. He reached to Glenn Greenwald, whom we worked with on a Snowden film. And we arranged a little campaign. And after that, the Rumble guy, Pavlovsky, reached me out. And we published it in the Rumble. It's like, Kaiser, like 2.8 million of you for just a few weeks. And yes, and Vimeo, I use Vimeo to seed Ukraine on Fire to everyone who want. And I publish it in a way when it's impossible to understand, because it's not screening. It's just the source of, I can do it with Dropbox, but Vimeo after that kill all entire our account on Vimeo, proven. But until this time, 2,000 copy at least, or 3,000 copy was downloaded, and people start publishing this. And we do nothing. We not fight against the copyright violation, because we believe that our little income, what we're gathering from the film, less important than people knowing the truth. And yes, we was everywhere. We are on every platform. We like have probably hundreds on the Rumble and other Odyssey and YouTube. So Ukrainian Fire penetrate the market, and people watching this, and they love it. They love it. I believe we make a right choice, and we make it fast. So this is and after that, suddenly YouTube undelete our film and said, because we blame them for this. So they try to retreat, to make a damage control. They undelete film, but they restrict it. They said this is a brutal imagery. This is a movie about the war. Yeah, this is a very, very, very brutal image. So you advised. You need to be advised, and people loved it as well, because if you restrict something, people jump in on this, and that's how we run this our publicity campaign with the censorship, and this is how Ukraine on Fire have a second chance to be seen widely. I'm very proud of this film. It's my baby, and it's my first directorial debut. So I this was my first directing, because Oliver forced me to do that. He said, I want to just produce it, but he said, no. You know story so well, you need to direct, because you cannot explain this. You need to explain it to the audience instead of explaining it to the director. Thank you, Patrick.
Igor Lopat. Thank you, Igor. Igor Lopatinik, filmmaker, director of Ukraine on Fire, Revealing Ukraine, and many other great films. Thank you very much for sharing your story with us. Everybody, thank get out there, see the film on the different platforms and so forth. Thank you, Greg Sharkey, for joining us this week on TNT. And thank you, Christian, our research assistant in the first hour. Yes, and thank you, Igor. And we'll be watching your work over and over again. It's a great history lesson. Listen, everybody, that's all we've got time for this week.
Thank you, Patrick.
You're listening to TNT. Thank you, Igor. We're listening to TNT, Today's News Talk. Take care, Greg, Igor, Christian, everybody out there listening. Much appreciated. All the best. And stay tuned to TNT.